Our last lesson, we finished chapter number 19. We're ready to begin tonight on chapter 20. Job chapter 19 was the conclusion of Job's response to Eliphaz. And here in chapter 20, we have Zophar's second speech in the series of speeches in which Job and his friends are engaged. Zophar's opening comments respond to the final warning that Job gave in his response to Eliphaz. And Zophar just apparently is thin-skinned, and he thought that he had been insulted by what Job had had to say. And what Job had had to say was simply he was following a variation in the theme of the fate of the wicked. And there's going to be a great deal more to be said about the fate of the wicked. And of course, the friends taking the position that if Job was suffering, then he was a sinner, he was a wicked man. And their theology has not changed a bit. Job, as we've studied, finds out, believes, and has been told even by God that he is righteous and that there is no man anywhere like Job. God had no man like Job. So Job was in a class all by himself as far as his relationship with God was concerned. And the three friends, and I say it that way because that's about the only way I can put quotation marks around the word friends, because they're anything but friends to Job. They were to comfort him, but Job, after experience with them, said, "Poor comforters are ye all." So they really have nothing to say about Job's argument concerning the suffering and death of the righteous. And that's one thing that Job has been saying all along, is that the righteous also suffer. And he understands and believes greatly that he is one of those people. But the problem with the friends is their theology does not admit any such possibility. It's impossible to see a man suffering and somehow believe at the same time that that man is a righteous man. And Zophar, bless his heart, has just been stung by the way that Job discredited his claim for wisdom and understanding. Verses 2 and 3 of the chapter. "Therefore my thoughts answer me because of my haste within me. I hear censure that insults me, and out of my understanding a spirit answers me." He has the spirit of wisdom. He has wisdom that Job doesn't know. He has wisdom that Job doesn't understand. And Zophar bases his assertion on common and timeless knowledge that men have known forever. And he is simply surprised that Job doesn't know those things. Certainly, Zophar knows them, and Zophar thinks that Job ought to know them. Verse 4, he says, "Do you not know this from of old, since man was placed on earth, that the exalting of the wicked is short?" Doesn't make much difference to Zophar as to what Job says. The friends just keep repeating and repeating and repeating what their position is, and they expect Job to bow to them in their great wisdom. Verses 5 to 11. I read a part of verse 5 a while ago, that the exulting of the wicked is short, and the joy of the godless but for a moment, though his height mount up to the heavens and his head reach to the clouds. He will perish forever like his own dung. Those who have seen him will say, where is he? He will fly away like a dream and not be found. He will be chased away like a vision of the night. The eye that saw him will see him no more, nor will his place be any more behold him. His children will seek the favor of the poor, and his hands will give back his wealth. His bones are full of his youthful vigor, but it will lie down with him in the dust. Now, if there ever was a pronunciation against a man that it's all over, Job, give up, this is it. The joy of the godless, he is telling us, is brief. Yeah, you know, you may have a day or two that's good if you're a wicked man, but it's not going to last, Job. Be ready for grief, because the joy of the godless is something that is brief. It is short. But Job has already recognized that the life of man is transitory. It is brief. And everybody already has acknowledged that. So Zophar is not telling them anything that they did not know, had not heard, and did not believe. Job's position is that the life of all men is transitory, and it doesn't make any difference at all whether they are good or bad. His retribution is going to be dramatic. Verses 6 and 7 are going to be swift. Verse 8, he dies while his bones are still full of youthful vigor. That means they don't live to a ripe old age. Because of their wicked living, they're going to die while they are yet young, and their bones are still filled with vigor, youthful vigor. By his evasion, Zophar concedes that present experience might not give the final answer. And present experience, of course, is seeing Job in his condition, having lost everything, having gone to sit out on the ash heap, where he, with a piece of broken pottery, scratches his sores. That's what they're seeing, and he seems to be conceding here that that may not be the final answer. He may have moved closer to Job's position that confidence in God's justice is not based on observation, but it's a matter of trust and hope. You don't determine a man's relationship with God by observing what his condition is, whether he's suffering or whether he's not suffering, whether he's downhearted or whether he is filled with joy. That's not the way you determine a man's relationship with God. The way you determine a man's relationship with God is by the trust and the hope that he has in God, regardless of whatever his condition is. That whatever his condition is, he hasn't lost his faith, he hasn't lost his hope, and that describes Job to a T. Verses 12 to 18. Though evil is sweet in his mouth, though he hides it under his tongue, though he is loath to let it go and holds it in his mouth, yet his food is turned in his stomach. It is the venom of cobras within him. He swallows down riches and vomits them up again. God cast them out of his belly. He will suck the poison of cobras. The tongue of a viper will kill him. He will not look upon the rivers, the streams flowing with honey and curds. He will give back the fruit of his toil and will not swallow it down. From the profit of his trading, he will get no enjoyment. Zophar still has some comments to make. And to be honest, I think there probably is some realism in what Zophar has said in his remarks. They have some foundation in fact. The truth of the matter is, if judgment is a slow process, it is because God uses a person's own wickedness to bring about his downfall. And we've seen that many times in Scripture, and that's one of the things that is taking place here. Neglect and mistreatment of the poor is one of the worst faults of the rich. Verse 19. For he has crushed and abandoned the poor. He has seized a house that he did not build. Now, that's a good comment by Zophar. And it may be true somewhere with somebody. But he has never, ever seen Job do any of that. What he's doing now is just making up good stories about the generality of those who are wicked and those whom God rejects and those whom God punishes, because God all through Scripture has talked about the sin of mistreating the poor and the neglected and the widows, the orphans, and so on and so forth. So everybody knows that neglect and mistreatment of the poor is a very bad thing to do. And it characterizes many of those who are rich because they've gotten many of their riches as a result of mistreating the poor and stealing things from the widows. Verses 20 to 22. Because he knew no contentment in his belly, he will not let anything in which he delights escape him. There was nothing left after he had eaten. Therefore, his prosperity will not endure. In the fullness of his sufficiency, he will be in distress. The hand of everyone in misery will come against him. These verses fall into a category that we've seen several times in the book of Job. And that is that the verses here in 20 to 22 are not all that clear. And for that reason, when you study Job, you discover that there are a number of different translations given to these verses. But regardless of different translations given to the verses, there are at least three basic things that can be learned by any translation of the verses. And they are, number one, that the rich man is dissatisfied with what he has and he wants more. Well, now, wait a minute. I know some folks that seem to have a lot of this world's goods and they're not like that. Well, I'll take the position that then they're not rich. I take that based upon my understanding of New Testament passages where Jesus said it's easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than it is for a rich man to go to heaven. I don't think a camel can go through the eye of a needle. And I've heard people explain it, as you have, by saying, well, you know, in the wall there was a place called the camel's needle, and they had to get down on their knees and unload all of their gear so they could get their camel through that, get all of their gear through, put it back on the camel, and then they were inside the wall. But Jesus didn't say anything about a hole in the wall. He talked about an eye of a needle. And I have an idea that some of the women standing around there who sewed immediately understood what Jesus was talking about. Well, does it mean then that it's impossible for a rich man to go to heaven? Yes. But I define that as a man who loves his riches more than he loves his God. And that's what Jesus was talking about. It's not just talking about a man who has some of the goods of this world. As long as he doesn't put that ahead of God, and as long as he uses it for good purposes and to take care of those who have need, he is not rich as I believe it in the eyes of God. If you want to believe the hole in the wall, that's fine too. They both get maybe to the same place, but I just take it for what it says there. Number two, the man who has the goods of the world often has a dramatic reversal in what he has. How many people have had millions of dollars, maybe into billions, but have lost it all. I can't name any by name as I stand here, but I'm confident there are some. I heard just on the radio a day or so ago about a man who at one point had, I think, $500 million, but his daughter was trying to get about $20,000 out of his estate. Well, I don't know what happened to his estate, but it is a living illustration that people who have a great deal sometimes lose it all. And that is what Zophar and others are saying about the rich who are suffering, and that is, well, they may have it now, but they're not going to have it long, and he'll fall into want because of reversal of his fortune. Number three out of these verses. When he falls into want, that is poverty, his suffering will be greater because he is used to having plenty. He's a man who doesn't just go buy him a golf club, he buys a whole new set. And he doesn't go and play at the country club, he buys him a country club. And then all of a sudden, all of that is gone. And he can't go down to the hardware store and buy a hammer. And he doesn't know quite how to take it. But the one thing he does know how to take it is he doesn't like it. He's used to having plenty, doing what he wants to, when he wants to, going where he wants to go, when he wants to go, buy what he wants to buy. And now he cannot do it. Verses 23 to 29. To fill his belly to the full, God will send his burning anger against him and rain it upon him into his body. He will flee from an iron weapon. A bronze arrow will strike him through. It is drawn forth and comes out of his body. The glittering point comes out of his gallbladder. Terrors come upon him. Utter darkness is laid up for his treasures. A fire not fanned will devour him. What is left in his tent will be consumed. The heavens will reveal his iniquity, and the earth will rise up against him. The possessions of his house will be carried away, dragged off in the day of God's wrath. This is the wicked man's portion from God, the heritage decreed for him by God. References to these various weapons, if you recall some of the chapters we've studied, are really painful echoes of some of the things that Job has said in his description of God's wrath upon him as he sees it, particularly in chapter 16 and 19. And Zophar is saying, Job, you want to know, you've been talking about, you want things from God, you want to know what you get from God, you want to know what your portion from God is going to be. Your portion from God is going to be recognizing a final, decisive day of the wrath of the Almighty. That's the way you're going to end up, Job. Job has a response to Zophar. Chapter 21. The time has come for Job to, shall we say, demolish his friend's position. In counterattack, Job appeals to prior statements that are a good guide to, I think, interpretation. By quoting their words and refuting them, Job comes closer to formal debate than just the conversations that they have been having. His words are emotional, but they are less invective than some of the words that Job has used in prior responses. Let's look at verses 2 to 5 in chapter 21. Keep listening to my words, and let this be your comfort. Bear with me, and I will speak, and after I have spoken, mock on. As for me, is my complaint against man? Why should I not be impatient? Look at me and be appalled, and lay your hand over your mouth. Pretty straight language from Job. Job's friends have not had any sympathy for him. They haven't had any empathy for him. And they are discovering that Job is, I hesitate to use the word, but I think it fits, Job is angered by his friends' lack of empathy for him. A more fitting response would be to be appalled, which we saw in chapter and verse 5 in the first part of this verse, or silent, the second part of the verse. You just look at it, be appalled, and if you really want to give me some comfort, if you really want to do me a favor, how about putting your hand over your mouth? And let's just don't hear any more from you or what you have to say. Just to listen, which is talked about in verse 2 in the first part, would be consolation. If instead of talking, you just listen to what I have to say and try to understand it, that might give me some consolation, but you haven't given me any thus far. Verse 4 implies that God is the source of Job's trouble. He's at least implied that before. And his friends, of course, agree with that. But they both come from different directions. Job is wanting to know why. And he wants to know how that is consistent with his faith and his hope in God that he continues to have. And the friends believe it because Job is suffering. Suffering means sin. Sin means unrighteous. And that means God's going to get Job. So his friends sort of agree with that statement. Verses 6 to 16. Getting the right chapter here. When I remember, I am dismayed, and shuddering seizes my flesh. Why do the wicked live, reach old age, and grow mighty in power? Their offspring are established in their presence, and their descendants before their eyes. Their houses are safe from fear, and no rod of God is upon them. Their bull breeds without fail, their calves and does not miscarry. They send out their little boys like a flock, and their children dance. They sing to the tambourine and the lyre and rejoice to the sound of the pipe. They spend their days in prosperity, and in peace they go down to Sheol. They say to God, depart from us. We do not desire the knowledge of your ways. What is the Almighty that we should serve him? And what profit do we get if we pray to him? Behold, is not their prosperity in their hand? The counsel of the wicked is far from me. The thesis of Job's friends here is that sin produces suffering. And the inference is that suffering proves sin. Where you see suffering, you automatically know that there is a sinner with no other evidence, nothing else. If he's suffering, he's a sinner. And Job denies both of those things. Job denies that the wicked die prematurely. Zophar says that they do. We just read a while ago out of chapter 20 that they die and their bones are still young. But Job says, no, that's not the case. They do not die prematurely. Bildad says in chapter 18, verse 19, that they don't have any posterity. They don't have any kids to follow after them. Job denies that and says that they have plenty of kids. And not only do they have a lot of kids, they have a lot of kids that have a good time. They dance and they listen to the music and so forth, as he described it here in these verses. The wicked, Job is saying, have large and happy families. The houses of the wicked are secure. They're not losing their houses. They're not being taken away from them. They're not falling down. They are in good shape. They live there. They enjoy their homes. And the only thing that Job sort of complains about is that the rod of God that Job is feeling is not upon the wicked as they enjoy all of the good things of life that they possess. Job may be beginning to learn why belief in God does not enable us to answer all of the questions or to account for everything that happens under the sun. By Job's standard, any faith that cannot be lived every day in all circumstances is absolutely worthless. Now, I would say, let me repeat that. But I want you to turn over to Philippians, and I'll repeat it from a different person and in different language, but it's saying exactly the same thing. Turn, please, to Philippians. And in Philippians, go to chapter 4. And in chapter 4, go to verse 11. Paul is writing, "Not that I am speaking of being in need, for I have learned in whatever station I am to be content. I know how to be brought low. I know how to abound. In any and every circumstance, I have learned the secret of facing plenty and hunger, abundance and need." And verse 13, one that everybody can quote, "I can do all things through Him who strengthens me." And I'll tell you, I think that passage is probably misused about as much as any passage in the Scripture. Because Paul is saying, I can take whatever circumstances my life gives me under God because I have faith in God and everything is going to be fine with me. I can take it all because God is with me. And it doesn't mean that I can do everything I want to do because God's on my side. I can't see over a 6-foot man, much less a 6.5-foot man. I don't care how much God is with me. He didn't make me that tall. I can't run in a race. Because when I tried football years ago in the 9th grade, my coach kept telling me, "Hall, you may be little, but you're sure slow." There are some things that I can't do. There are some things that you can't do. And God didn't make us where we can. So don't use that verse that way. It's an abuse of the Scripture. But be thankful, and be thankful to the God of heaven that you and I can take any circumstance that this old world can give us because God is on our side. Sermon over. Not only are those who are wicked prosperous, not only do they have big and happy families who are cared for carefully, even their cattle do well. Their cows bear. They're fertile. And they don't lose them. They don't miscarry. And when the wicked die, Job is saying the wicked die with no ill effects as far as their life is concerned. Not talking about eternity. Talking about things under the sun. The wicked will enjoy all of this while practicing the most presumptuous profanity that man can engage in. What's God ever done for me? Why should I pray to Him? What am I going to get out of it? I don't have any need for God. That's what Job is putting in their mouths, and properly so. The wicked's prosperity is not of his own making. And Job will have none of the wicked's counsel. He doesn't want anything to do with them. Verses 17 to 22. How often is it that the lamp of the wicked is put out, that their calamity comes upon them, that God distributes pains in His anger, that they are like straw before the wind and like chaff that the storm carries away. You say, God stores up their iniquity for their children. Let Him pay it out to them, that they may know it. Let their own eyes see their destruction, and let them drink of the wrath of the Almighty. For what do they care for their houses after them? When the number of their months is cut off, will any teach God knowledge, seeing that He judges those who are on high? When Job's friends say that the wicked do not prosper, Job says, you're wrong. The wicked do in fact prosper. The friends respond that the prosperity of the wicked doesn't last long. And Job has a question for them. It must be Harvard-style debate, because in Harvard-style debate, you do get to interrupt your opponent and ask him a question. And I found that to be very effective when I was in debate. But be that as it may, Job wants to know, how long does it take for their lamp to go out? How often is the lamp of the wicked put out? And the truth of the matter is, if you start looking at it, it's no sooner, it's no later than occurs to the righteous. Sometimes it occurs to the righteous because some of the unrighteous kill them. The unrighteous lives, the righteous are gone. So Job is putting them to the test. Okay, you say it's not going to last long. How long does it last? And I assure you that they have no answer for that. Verses 19 to 21, if the punishment of the wicked is delayed, then what happens is the friends just fall back another step. They step back to the children. Because if the wicked are not punished during the life of the wicked, the parents, then you just leave it all to the kids, and the children of the wicked will pay for it. Job considers this to be encouragement of depravity. What do they care about what happens to their descendants, is what the friends are saying. And I have found few people so wicked that they have no care for their children. Verse 22, Job checks himself with the confession that God's ways are inscrutable and He judges all, and it doesn't make any difference how exalted they may be or how low they may be. God is going to be the judge of all of them. Verses 23 to 26, one dies in his full vigor, being wholly at ease and secure, his pails full of milk. That's a vivid description, isn't it? I like that description. holy, at ease, and secure, his pails full of milk, and the marrow of his bones moist. They haven't dried out yet, still young. Another dies in the bitterness of soul, never having tasted of prosperity. They lie down alike in the dust, and the worms cover them. Job is saying, you know, life doesn't disclose any patterns. What he's really saying here is that you can talk all you want to, but when you start looking at who lives the longest, what you do learn, if you can't determine whether the wicked or the righteous live the longest, because it just both of them go, the thing you learn is that death for everybody has the last word. It's appointed unto man once to die, and after that the judgment. So it doesn't make much difference which category you're in as far as death is concerned, because death has the final say-so. And in life, no moral differences explain the diversities of their common fate, that is, of their death. And you can't say, well, the moral live, the immoral don't live, because they both die. And as Job says, they're going to be sweet to the worms. Now, we may not like to hear that, but we all die, and that's the flesh, not the spirit, not the soul. Verses 27 to 34. Behold, I know your thoughts and your schemes to wrong me. For you say, where is the house of the prince? Where is the tent in which the wicked live? Have you not asked those who travel the roads? And do you not accept their testimony that the evil man is spared in the day of calamity, and he is rescued in the day of wrath? Who declares his way to his face, and who repays him for what he has done? When he is carried to the grave, watch is kept over his tomb. The clods of the valley are sweet to him. All mankind follows after him, and those who go before him are innumerable. How then will you comfort me with empty nothings? There is nothing left of your answers but falsehood. 27 to 28, those two verses. The thinking of the friends, Job is saying, is so dishonest that it can only come from one source. And that is, it can only arise from malice. Their accusations rarely come out into the open, but their inferences are obvious. As we listen to what the friends have to say, what they really intend to say, as far as Job is concerned. Verse 29, Zophar appeals to the universe of knowledge. That was talked about back in chapter 20 and verse 4. Job responds that he hadn't been around much, but any traveler can tell you that life is the opposite of what you friends are saying. What you're saying is not true, and you can just go stop any traveler down the highway and talk to him, and you'll find out that he doesn't agree with what you are saying. Verses 30 to 34. The wicked are reserved, some translations say spared, in the day of calamity, and they will be led forth on that day. There will be a day that is coming, and they'll be led forth on that day. And who will tell him that he is wicked? And who will take him to court? Who will make him pay? Truth of the matter is, there's not anybody probably who could. And Job recognizes that. They're going to treat people. They're going to mistreat people. And there's not anything that the folks can do about it. They're going to have to live with it. And there's nobody who can take him to court and make him pay for the evil things that he has done. And the truth is that with these folks, even in death, the wicked have the advantage, because when they die, they have men watching over their tomb. I can take you right to the very spot in Texas where my mama and daddy are buried side by side. But I assure you there's nobody watching over their tombs except on Decoration Day. And that's when everybody goes to clean up the cemetery. And those who have prosperity, they can have people watching over their tomb. And even the dust of the earth favors them. Job says the clods of the, how does he express it? The clods of the valley are sweet to him. That means he gets the good dirt poured over him, I guess. But he's taken care of in every respect that a man can be taken care of. Men will follow after him, and men will go before him. And what Job has been offered for comfort, every bit of it is vain and false. Absolutely every bit of it. That gets us to the end of chapter 21. And Lord willing, next class we'll start with number 22. At the point we are, we have finished the first two rounds of speeches. And in the third and last round, we'll discover that Job's friends are running out of gas. Because Eliphaz has little to say, and Bildad has nothing to say. So they're running out of gas, they're running out of things to say, and the victory for Job is close. And when I say the victory, I mean the victory over the friends. And keep in mind that when we get to the real final, that Job is going to be the victor insofar as they are concerned, because God will tell them that what you said was not true, and I'm willing to forgive you, but on one condition. You go and ask Job to offer a sacrifice for you. And if he offers a sacrifice for you, then I'll forgive you. In case you haven't read the last page of this book, which is where most folks start with a good book, Job's a better man than, start to say most of us, let me just be honest, than I am. Because if I had friends treat me that way, and they came and said, sacrifice for me that I might be forgiven, I might say, you're kidding. But Job was bigger than that. We'll discover all of that when we get to the end of the book. Thank you for your presence and your good attention.